Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hi everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome to episode 400 of the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have you company for another episode of the show. If you're a first-time listener, welcome to the program. It's great to have you here. And if you're a repeat listener, well, welcome back. It's great to have you here as well. Now, today for our 400th episode, we've got something really special because we're talking about a topic that is critically important for any business, including dentistry, and that is, of course, selling. And my guest today has been described as the greatest salesperson in Australia. And I'm talking about John Rocker, who is the owner of Sydney City Lexus and Toyota, which is the largest car dealership, largest Toyota dealership in the Southern Hemisphere. Now, what's really interesting is John knows people, and whether you're selling cars, doing dentistry, running any kind of business, whether it's a jewelry store, whether it's a lawyer's firm, whatever it happens to be, we are all dealing with people. And John understands people perhaps better than anyone I've ever met. And in this episode, he's going to unpack his process because selling cars, selling dentistry, any of those things is a process. And what he's also going to show is how he's trained his workforce of 260 people to follow this process too. So you get scale and you get leverage. And this episode is packed with absolute gems. And what you'll find at the end of this is one of the keys to John's success is empathy, which sounds a little bit different when you're thinking about selling. Other people talk about it in different ways, but I really resonated with how John described it. So there's lots of goodies coming up for you in this episode. Now, before we get into the episode with John, I want to tell you about a training that we have coming up, and that is called The Productive Dentist. So one of the frustrations many dentists have is they don't feel productive. In fact, one of the frustrations many practice owners have is their associates aren't as productive as they are. So in this one-day workshop, we're going to talk to you about how to drive your productivity through the roof. We're going to talk to you about how to fill your appointment book because you need patients coming through the door. But even once you've got those patients coming through the door, we need to be able to offer treatment and have it accepted. So we're going to talk about case acceptance as well. And then once that treatment's been accepted, you need to be able to do that treatment really well to a high standard efficiently. So we're going to talk about workflows and how to work efficiently. And that productive workshop has been created by demand. People were screaming out for it, so we created it. It's sold out over and over again in the past. And we're running this as a one-day online course. So that means you can join from the comfort of your own practice. You don't need to travel. You don't need to do any of that. We're delivering it live online and we'd love to see you there. So I'm going to put the link in the show notes so you can check that out as well. We'd love to see you there. Now, back to our conversation with John. He's going to go through a bunch of things with you. I'm sure you're going to love it. So have a pen and paper handy. And what you'll hear is some absolute pearls of wisdom as well as some real warmth and humanity. And you'll see why he is the greatest salesperson in Australia. Here's John. John Rocker, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us today on the Savvy Dentist Podcast. How's things up in Sydney town?
Oh, thanks, Jess. No, it's great to be here. It's been very good. It's very hot at the moment, but all good. We're surviving these interesting times and challenges, I guess.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting time and, you know, we're recording this in March 2023. We've had a couple of years of topsy-turviness with pandemics and now we're talking about interest rates and all the hullabaloo about all that sort of stuff. And I'll be keen to get your thoughts on that as we go through. But yeah, John, your name has come up on my radar a few times in recent months. I listened to other podcasts and then someone else said to me, hey, did you hear this podcast with John? It was great, blah, blah. And so I've been really dying to have a chat to you. And obviously, you know, you're most well known as the owner of Sydney City Toyota and Lexus, and you've got a reputation for being really masterful at sales, and not only that, but helping other people learn those skills as well. So I thought we might dig into that a bit today, if that's cool with you. But, mate, you've got an interesting backstory, though, and you migrated from Spain as a young fella?
Yeah, that's right. I was born in Cordoba, southern Spain, and left there with my family, my sister and my parents. We moved and migrated to Germany on a temporary visa many moons ago. And in 1972, we landed in Australia. So a little bit of a confused kid, learning Spanish, went to German and then started off with no English.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, quite an interesting journey in my very early years, but one that sort of hangs with me, and I get a lot of out of through my entire life, actually.
I'm really interested about the backstories, because sometimes I feel like those early childhood experiences shape us and they tend to, you know, turn us into who we are. Certainly in my case, that's been the case. How did that migrant experience shape you? What were the attributes, or what were the things you took from that experience that you kind of see still in your DNA today coming through in what you do?
I guess the biggest one for me is that you think, as a six-year-old landing in a new country where you don't speak the language, it's I think it just gives you a lot of confidence, because you think, well, that's where I came from. So surely when a challenge comes up, I don't see it as much of a challenge maybe a normal person would. I think I've gotten through, my philosophy has always been ride the wave and we'll get through it. I mean, you look back on bad times as much as good times, and I just have this confidence that no matter what the challenge is, I can get through this. And I think that was a big one, and I learnt that very early on in the piece and sort of carried it with me.
I really, really love that confidence that comes through, and I think it's a useful thing, because a lot of people might not rise to the challenge. And obviously you mentioned the introduction that we're going through some challenging times, and I'm guessing you're just going to ride the wave and get through that.
Yeah.
I was listening to some of the interviews you've given in the past, and I noticed that you grew up in a family business. Your dad was a jeweler and your mum a seamstress. What was a day in the life of young John like back in those days?
It was interesting. It was basically a retail and a manufacturing business that my father owned. So workshop at the back, jewellery store at the front. I'd finish school or rugby league training, and I'd come home and I'd be at the back of the shop until all hours just watching. As I got a little bit older, I got more interested in not so much how the jewellery was made, but more so how it was sold. I really enjoyed that interaction with customers. There were some real characters that Dad had as customers, and I'd like to listen every now and then. When a popular one came in, I'd sort of sneak out the front and just sit by the side and listen and watch this, see how it was done.
And what about your mum? What was the influence she had on you in that regard from a business point of view?
Probably work ethic for mum. I mean, they both were very sort of hard-working, sort of typical migrant story, but mum's story was a little bit different. She was working for somebody else. She wasn't working for herself. But just what I learned from mum was, it was quite interesting, because we all were trying to learn English at the time. And mum was working as a seamstress, as you mentioned, and everybody there was Italian. So mum comes out of work fluent in Italian and not English. But there was a real sort of community of immigrants there. And I think, you know, that enjoyment in the workplace is what I learned from mum. Dad had his own business, so the struggles were there, the financials, the rest of it. You know, like any business, whether dentistry or any of the business, Dad had the same challenges. But for mum, for me, it was that you can enjoy work life as well and have that balance. But I guess it was just that ethic in terms of hard work is really the silver bullet. It's not really much anything else. You need a little bit of luck along the way. But I tend to think that you sort of create your own luck as you go along the way as well.
I grew up in a family where I often say there's a lot of love, not a lot of money. And that was a real driver for me, not to kind of go through that. And I think that's where my work ethic came from, seeing mum and dad struggle, ultimately get through, but, you know, having a few sleepless nights and doing that sort of stuff. I remember thinking, I never, ever, ever want to be in that position. And and so learning all the things you need to. It's funny, those childhood experiences really shape you, and, you know, obviously yours have shaped you, mine have shaped me, and I'm sure everyone else's have shaped them.
Yes.
Your sister, I'm curious to ask, did she, you know, take up those same experiences as you, or was that just a uniquely John experience?
No, I think it was we're very close. So my sister Mary and I are very close. We grew up obviously in exactly the same environment, no cousins or relatives. So pretty much it was the four of us. So that love that you speak about in the family, I think is where my empathy comes from in sales. Very tight unit, sort of the four of us with friends that we sort of gained along the way. But she was, Mary was a lot more involved in her schoolwork, let's say, than I was. She was a far better student than I was, a lot more disciplined than I was. I was more staring out the windows while she was staring at the books. And took her own path through childcare and, sort of forced her career through there and worked for a university for a long time. But, different directions. We are different people, and she'll be the first to admit that as well. But a good balance.
Good stuff. So I guess that kind of leads into like how you found your way into selling, because as we're talking, I can see the footy jerseys behind you, and I know you've got a passion for rugby league. We've got the Blues jersey there and the Manly jersey. I thought the Manly jersey was the Queensland jersey. I was getting a bit excited there for a moment, but not to be. But how did you find your way into selling?
I never really knew what I wanted to do. I thought at one stage I was going to be a professional rugby league player. So I played through the junior ranks of the Canterbury Bulldogs. That's the area I sort of grew up in.
Yep.
And that's really all I wanted to do. But I had this fascination about cars for some reason, not the technical side, but I could tell you that, you know, the Ferrari had changed the tail light from one side to the other and all that sort of stuff in terms of design and the rest of it. So I felt that with my, upbringing, my confidence, my character, although I was told I was a very shy child as a young person, but I can't really remember those days, maybe because I couldn't speak the language, I was mistaken for being shy. But, yeah, getting back to the sales question, I thought, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I thought sales is probably something that I could do.
Mm.
And then I tried everything, as you and I discussed off air, and, you know, knocking on doors, selling Kirby vacuum cleaners in the early 80s for $2,500 and getting kicked out of home. Pots and pans and a lot of door selling, as you could relate to, I'm sure.
Yeah, I did that.
A little bit of that, yeah. So, yeah, I think that's where it came from. It was like the school of hard knocks when it came to sales. It doesn't get any rawer than knocking on a cold door, as you know.
Mm.
But I just felt that, I don't know, I wasn't the clown of the class, but I just got along with people. It's just, as much as I like cars, I liked people. And I thought, if I like people, I think I can sell or represent something that I'm passionate about, and cars was it for me.
You mentioned a really important word a little moment ago, and I don't want to gloss over it. You mentioned empathy.
Mm.
How important has that been for you in your career? Because we've only just met prior to starting this recording, but already I can sense warmth, and you're obviously a people person, and I've listened to you a lot, as I said, on podcasts, and that just shines through.
Oh, thanks, Jess.
Yeah, look, I really mean it, but where does that come from, and how important has it been for you?
Yeah, to me it comes from just liking people, I guess, and being, you know, we've all had experiences where we've been treated the wrong way, and I think, well, if I'm going to learn from somebody, our best lessons come from bad experience as much as good experience. And I remember I was told in the car business when I first started that I wasn't going to make it because I was too nice to people.
Hmm.
And when I started in the car industry, it was very different. It was, you know, let's close the deal, make sure the customer doesn't walk without a contract. It was different times completely. So in the initial thoughts of my first sales managers or managers, they thought, this kid's too nice. He can't really close a deal. And since then, it's been my silver bullet because, I've always been very good at letting people make a decision, confining them and make them comfortable to make the right decision, and lead them if I have to, because in sales, you do need to lead at times.
Yeah.
You are the specialist. So, you know, a salesperson that doesn't lead is really not doing the customer justice either. But I think it comes from the fact that, I just like people. I think that's where the empathy comes from. And I always think, if I'm sitting opposite as the customer, what do I want to hear?
Mm. I think you're talking about putting yourselves in the customer's shoes and trying to understand all those sorts of things. You obviously have a deep appreciation for the people that walk through your showroom door.
Yeah.
And similarly in a dental practice, we've got a pretty good idea of who's coming through the door, what their hopes and aspirations are, what their fears and frustrations might be, and all that sort of stuff. And I can't help but wonder if there's some similarities between people walking into your showroom and to my dental practice, in the sense that I don't want to tar you with my brush, but yeah, not many people come to the dentist because they love going to the dentist. And buying a car is a much more enjoyable experience. I recognize that, but without trying to sound off key, in the past, in the 80s and earlier, those car salesmen probably, because of that old methodology, created a bit of a reputation that may linger today. And I'm just curious how you can disarm people and relate to people and where this empathy kind of comes through.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's any different, is it? I mean, if you're walking into a dentist, as soon as you get that reminder, you think, oh, no.
Everyone's in that boat, yep.
It's exactly the same. I mean, nobody wants to walk into a car dealership and expect a fantastic experience, and that, and we've got the barriers no different to a dentist before our customers walk in. And we spend a lot of time training and discussing the experience of the buyer months before they walk in the door. What has gotten them to that point? And the minute we can put ourselves in their place, meaning they've spoken to family about budgets, they've spoken to the bank manager about how much they can spend, they've spoken to one another about what type of car, what colour. So there's so much empathy there in the train of thought of, we don't just see a customer when they walk in the door as, well, here's another customer. That we were referred to in my industry, I might have you a long time ago, as a head.
Oh, my God,
so there's
really?
A head at the door. So we've come a long way from the door, from the person that walks in the door being called a head. We now call them a guest.
Yeah.
And we like to treat them like a guest in their own home. But if you put yourself in the position of somebody who's been thinking about buying a car, we know that the average person that's been thinking about buying one started 12 months ago and were very active 6 months ago, and 3 weeks before they see us, they've already seen somebody else.
Wow.
So we already know what they've been through. And one of the things that I really focus on is we have a process, which is one, and we can talk about that.
Yep.
But the other part is getting my team to empathise with the person that walks in the door. Don't look at them as the next customer. They're really a guest in your own home, and it should be a completely different discussion to the previous customer or guest that we've just spoken to or sold the car to. So it's putting yourself in that position and understanding the fear of that person and what they're thinking about us before they meet us.
So what I'm hearing then out of that is very relational. It's very personalised, it's very relational. We've gone from a transactional, there's a head kind of person, to making sure we're having individualised, customised, personalised conversations that are different from one guest to the next. And
absolutely,
I do want to get to this process if we can, but can I just linger on the word guest for a second? Because I think that's a very deliberate word, and I don't think that your customer experience happens by accident.
No.
So I'm guessing that as you've designed your customer experience, you've been thinking about every single touch point in that process and thinking, what do I want my guests to think, feel, or understand at this particular point in the journey? Is that reasonable?
Absolutely, spot on. But even going further than that, Jess, I look at what my people are going through, and I focus on my team, how we can create the experience, because whether you're visiting the dentist or the doctor or the car salesman, there is a team of people that actually create that experience for your customer or patient.
Yes.
So you can have the world's best personality, but if three people in your staff or the receptionist is the stuffiest receptionist that you've ever met at the dentist, you're probably not going to go back, and there's the beginning of the experience. So I'm really focused on giving my staff a good experience, and a good experience means that they're well-trained, they're aligned with my thinking and what I want in my business, and aligned with one another. So the experience isn't just what the dentist does, it's what the receptionist does the minute your guest walks in your door. And that's critical before we even get into the process of the sale. We get into the process of how we're going to support each other during that sale as well.
Okay, so before we get to the process, we've got an environment that we're creating.
Yep.
And that environment has, if we're going to use the word guest for our customers, we might use the word cast for our team, a bit Disney-esque. But there is a production going on, there is an alignment, there is a process underlying all of this, and it's all being done with an intent and a specificity to support the customer, to support the decision-making process. So let's get into your process.
Okay, so I call it the evolution process, and evolution is basically 10 steps to a sale. And if it's not 10 steps, it doesn't mean 10 steps to a sale today. And I think that's where the edge is in my business, that we don't need to sell the car to you today. What we need to do is inform you, impress you, serve you, and hopefully sell the car today. But if we don't, that's okay as well. And in my industry, that was voodoo. That's why I was told that I was too nice, because I'd let people go and let them think about it, but give them such an experience that if they went somewhere else to buy the same car, the experience was inferior.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a knack for them coming back to me because of the experience. And the evolution process goes from the minute the guest walks in the door
mm-hmm.
to the day, we call it the wedding day, mm-hmm. to the day of delivery.
Yep.
And then the day of delivery is when you pick up the car, and there are many steps to get to that point through the evolution process, which all my staff are trained on. And then once we've delivered the car and our new guest is in their new car, that's when our relationship begins with what we call pillar two customers. Pillar one is a fresh guest, somebody we've never met before.
Yep.
And then pillar two are nurturing our current customers for life. And how do you build that relationship between one car and the next? And that's what the good people do in my industry.
So there's about a bazillion things I want to ask you right now. I'll start on the evolution if I can. I'm just wondering if you can walk us through a couple of those 10 steps that might be just, you know, transferable from your industry to ours. So we can just get a bit of an idea of what's actually happening in that process.
So let me give you a classic example. So let's start with the evolution when we first meet a customer. We practice everything from the handshake to the non-handshake, depending on, you know, what the background or religion might be of the customer, which we can pick up at times.
Yep.
And there are various ways of doing that. But for us, the introduction is a big part of it. And the other part is there's a magic minute or two where you can leave a customer on their own, but after that, it becomes a problem.
Mm.
And I've got to say that, you know, in any medical field or industry, that's where I find that the industry has really missed the mark.
Mm.
And that is that if we've been expecting you and you've sent me a reminder 6 months ago that I need my teeth done or cleaned or check up, you've been expecting me for a long time.
Yeah.
But the time that you've got my details, you know what my issue is, you know when I'm fronting up, and then the classic half-hour wait.
Yeah.
Non-productive hours that if you calculate them for a dentist, you know, in a year, you've lost months of production time and profit
to
your business, and making unhappy customers at the same time is something that I owned a dentistry, I'd be looking at very, very wisely and carefully, and saying if our guest walks in at, you know, 12:15 appointment, we've got to be ready at 12:15.
Mm.
And then we go all the way through evolution to the day of delivery, as I said, of the car.
Yep.
And when you leave, it's this is the option for you, John, for your next appointment. Now, I run a large business with 260 staff. I travel a lot. I never get asked when it suits me. I always get told when it suits the doctor or the dentist.
Mm.
So there are little bits and pieces that are the gold that you can say, hey, John, you've been coming to me for 5 years. You're a pillar two client or patient of mine. I'm not going to just throw you out the front of reception. She's going to hand you a card and write down when I can do you next. Right? It's about understanding who I am and how busy I am, probably busier than most dentists. So when does it suit me as your guest for the next appointment is what I should be asked. And they're the little bits and pieces that we work out in our industry to get those little bits right.
We have a process for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we call it the cascading series of alternate choices. And it's kind of this idea of rather than saying, so, John, would you want, you know, Monday at 8? Nah, can't do that. How about Monday at 9? Can't do that. How about Tuesday at 11? Can't do that. We usually just say, John, which days of the week are good and bad for you? You might say, look, Tuesdays and Wednesdays are my good days. Do you prefer morning or an afternoon? Actually, afternoons are better. Yeah, I've got this day at this time or that day at that time. Do any of those work for you?
Yeah, fantastic.
If yes, great, fantastic. If not, great, well, let's go to the next week or the week after or whatever.
Fantastic. And not as common as you would like it to be, but that's spot on. You're now treating that person as somebody that you value.
I think what I'm hearing what you're saying as well is it is about understanding, in crude terms, is the guest is the person who actually keeps the whole business afloat.
Absolutely.
So let's treat them really well, because we want those people to come back through time and again and they pay our wages, frankly, and, you know, that's what we've got to figure out.
Spot on. And word of mouth is the best advertising you'll ever do. You know, if I have a bad experience, I'll tell 10 people. If I have a good experience, I'll tell two. So work hard for the good one.
100%. So I do want to talk about know, like and trust and the pillar two relationship. We're talking off air and some of the listeners will know I'm very passionate about the whole customer retention or in our world patient retention process. And I've always had the view in dentistry, John, I don't know if this works in cars, but in dentistry, people come to us with their barriers up. And it, like you said something actually I really appreciate, and that is they might not buy today, yes, but I'm thinking about the future sale as well.
Yes.
And it's the same with us. We might have patients that come through, they need, you know, a ton of treatment. For whatever reason, they might not accept all of that treatment up front now, but they'll do a bit and that's fine. But yes, my goal is to always keep them on our books and just keep nurturing that relationship, knowing that the work will come.
Yep.
And the know, like and trust factor that people like to buy from whom they know, like and trust. I'm curious to ask how that works in your world because I remember you saying to me off air that some people come and buy the fifth generation, you know, Lexus, same car, and then others will go through an ascension process from a small car to a bigger car to a luxury car.
Yep.
Is there any particular profile or stats around that? Do most people come in and go, yeah, I'm going to go for the luxury Lexus, or do a lot of people come in and say, you know what, I'm going to start with a little Corolla to start with or whatever it is? What's it look like in your world?
It tends to follow the lifestyle of the individual. So if they find a car that suits them, they will buy the fifth generation of the same car.
Yep.
In some cases, you'll get the downsizers.
Yep.
And then you'll get the 20-year-old marries as their first child. It's no longer a Corolla. It's going to be a RAV because you put a baby seat in the back of it.
Yep.
In the back of the car. So, yeah, there's a tendency that you can almost categorize somebody and says, this is an RX Lexus owner, and you can make that mistake because people change. I mean, you know, the empty nesters sometimes get out of an SUV straight into a coupe that they've had their eye on for the last 10 years.
Because they've had kids in the back seat with a whole ecosystem of food in the back seat.
Exactly. So there's that. But I think... to your point, where you were getting to earlier, it's very similar in our part where we talk about the feature versus the benefit. And you were saying that you don't do it all at the same time. And I've experienced that as well. When you go in for a visit at the dentist, a couple of things are identified, but this is what we'll do today. Mm. I think where the strength is, and I always talk about selling being something that somebody doesn't want to buy. That's the definition of selling is you convince somebody to buy something they don't necessarily want, and that's the harsh definition of selling.
Yep.
And it is what it is. But I think the benefit that you sell as a dentist saying, this is what you need today, we'll get to the must-dos, and then I'll get you back for this. I think if you stretch that to one step further and not just point out the feature that needs to be done, but what is the benefit of having it done, you'll get a lot more pillar twos coming back as well if it's explained well.
Mm.
Almost there's a danger that if you don't come back to me at that time, it's going to be worse. It's going to be another five visits, not two. So feature versus benefit, I think, is something that we focus on. Well, it definitely is something we focus on. We don't just say the car has air conditioning. We'll say it has four-zone climate-controlled air conditioning.
Yep.
And there's a big difference. A lazy salesperson will say it has air conditioning.
Mm.
A great salesperson will say it's four different sections of the car will produce four different temperatures, depending on the temperature of the occupant, which that technology exists for Lexus, for example, but it's not always explained. So a good salesperson will go that step further.
And, of course, that then means you've got to know your product, know your guest,
yep,
listen intuitively, yeah, listen to what they're saying, listen to what's important to them, get that match right.
Yes.
So that you're putting them in the right car or, in our case, putting them into the right treatment.
Correct. Benefit of why you're doing that in your next two visits is to prevent four visits instead of two.
Yeah. Oh, mate, I love that. Now, you've got a large team, 260 people. I didn't actually realise you had that many team, and that's, mate, you have my complete admiration for that.
I've got some great people that help me, I can assure you.
And that's where I want to get to is because, you know, you're really well known for your ability to sell. You've got the evolution process that you take people through. But I'm guessing, you know, people walking into your you know, dealership as trainees or apprentices or whatever the right language is they've got to be trained, and you've got to take someone from being a rookie to a pro relatively quickly, because otherwise all the selling and all the revenue generation rests on a handful of, you know, on the heads of a handful of people, basically.
Yeah.
And so what I wanted to ask you is that training piece, because the same thing happens in dentistry. We often see the principal of the practice is has figured it out. I think they have an unexamined process. I don't think they've decoded what they're actually doing.
Yes.
And therefore they can't teach it. So I wanted to ask you, firstly, how you decoded what you did, and, you know, from being too nice in inverted commas to going, actually, this is a superpower. And then how did you decode that, and then how did you teach that is, I guess, what I'd like to ask.
I guess the first step is giving your people a good understanding of who you are.
Yeah.
Why you do what you do and why you're so successful at it, and then what your expectations are of them. Because, you know, I spend a lot of money on advertising. I do radio, I voice my own ads, I say come and meet my team, my award-winning team. Now, we're promising a lot, so we have to deliver when somebody rocks up at our dealership. So the alignment with my people is I have five general managers that are my top-tier guys. And everything that I believe in, they understand very, very clearly what my expectations are. They have their own opinions, of which I listen to as well, because they're in the trenches as much as I am, if not more so. And then we cascade that down to everybody. So everybody in our business, by having the evolution we call the playbook, if you like, we hang our hat on evolution. So we teach it from the car washer to the supplier that supplies us with tyres. Like, you know, if you drive up my driveway, you know, 30 kilometres when the car park says it's 15 and you're a tyre supplier delivering tyres, there's an expectation of you. So when we do induction, when we onboard people, we give people a really good idea of what our DNA is as a business. And I guess you have to have one to begin with, right?
Yeah.
Working out what that is, right?
Yeah.
But it's in the owner. The owner is there. So we put so much time aside for appointments, for certain things in life, but very little for training. So part of an afternoon of a week, put some time aside so your people understand what their expectations are and allow them to ask questions about how do I deliver what you want me to deliver if we're frantic, you know, 24/7. When do we get some downtime to develop and grow our business? So we're all aligned. And let me tell you, some of the best suggestions will come from your people. You don't have to think of everything as the owner of the business yourself, which at times we often do think it's only up to us. We direct, but we've got to listen as well. But having that time to train your people, onboard them well, and then let them understand the DNA of what it is that you want out of your practice, that is critical, because then they can then pass it on to your guest or patients the same way you can. I'm not creating rockets. I'm selling cars.
Mm.
Not difficult, but the difficult part is instilling it in others.
The thing about training, though, one of the things I've observed is, you know, I know you're a Manly fan and a Canterbury Bulldogs fan, but they're training 3, 4, 5 days a week and competing on the weekend, right? And in business, we're almost competing, dare I say, on the field, maybe not necessarily in the competitive sense, and I don't mean it like that, but you know, we're on the field 4, 5, 6 days a week, and so the ratio of on the field versus training is the reverse. And what I'm hearing you really clearly say is we've got to allocate that time, we've got to dedicate that time, we've got to structure that time, because we're seeing your business now with 260 people. It's a mature business. It's the most successful Toyota and Lexus dealership in the Southern Hemisphere. Accolade after accolade after accolade, but it perhaps wasn't always as polished as it is now, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you were talking to someone who is perhaps in the earlier stages of their business journey,
yes,
what would be a jumping off point or a starting point where you kind of go, okay, here's just one or two things to kind of get you started?
It would definitely be putting time aside to get to know my people.
Yep.
And more importantly, my people to get to know me. And that could be your receptionist and you as the dentist. Two people, but even more so because 50% is reliant on the other person.
Mm.
They're meeting your guests for the very first time. You get one shot at a first impression. You don't get a third impression in a first. It's only once. So to me, I would just really dumb it down to understand the background, the culture, what it is that we're trying to achieve. We're all in the people business. No matter what we're selling, whether it's a Crown or a Toyota Crown, it's the same thing, right? So we are selling products, and it just comes down to treating people the right way. So if I was to knock it down to absolute basics, I'd say two things. One is alignment, a clear understanding of how you want your customers treated in your business, and find the right people that will deliver that, and don't suffer fools that won't, because we are in business at the end of the day. It's not a popularity contest.
Yep.
And the other part is that things are going to go wrong, and learn from those mistakes. I have a theory that my guys will tell you about. It's called the five bomb theory.
Okay, here we go.
So I wake up in the morning and I think five bombs are going to go off today in my business. I don't know when. I don't know where, but they're going to happen. So how am I prepared for them? So when the first bomb goes off and somebody runs into my office and says, hey, a bomb's gone off, I'll say, okay, well, that's one bomb. Let's go and defuse it. And there are ways of doing that because we're all aligned. We understand what the issue is, but we get it wrong as well. So let's go and defuse it. If I have a day where I've had three bombs go off, that's a good day because I was expecting five. So I think make some mistakes is the short answer.
Yep.
Very, very well aligned, and keep it really, really simple. Don't complicate it. Don't start up a practice and think, I've got to be as good as the guy down the road who inspired me to do this. That happens over time. You find your own rhythm. You find your own niches, as I did, and you're never going to be perfect. But if you stick to basics, and I keep telling my guys, no matter how complicated our business becomes, we're always going to stick to basics. So that would be my advice if I was starting off. I think it's just alignment, training, and make some mistakes, learn from them, and don't complicate it.
John, I think you've just succinctly given just perhaps the best business advice that anyone could ever hear, because I really appreciate the mastery of fundamentals, keeping it simple, make those mistakes, expect some mistakes. I think there's absolute wisdom there. Just one last question I wanted to ask you, if I may, and it's a bit of a broad question, but I'm always curious about what drives people. I've always enjoyed talking to people. I've always enjoyed trying to figure out what they've done well. Maybe there's a lesson there for me that I can pick up and run with.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you about forks in the road. I'm just wondering if you can think of a fork in the road where you've had to make a choice and it's really had a meaningful impact on your life, a sliding doors moment, if you will. Have you had any of those in your business life where you've gone, I could have zigged, but I zagged, or something like that? And I'm curious to ask that from the point of view of what was the decision-making process and how that went.
Yeah, no, I've probably got the classic one because, I own Sydney City Toyota and Sydney City Lexus. Now, before I owned this many years ago, I was the sales manager at a different Toyota dealership. And Lexus was launched for the first time in Australia. And a colleague of mine left that Toyota dealership where I was working and became the service manager for Lexus for the first time ever, and that was in William Street. We were talking about it earlier.
Yeah.
So he goes over there and becomes the service manager, and they were looking for a salesperson. And I'd been around Toyota for a few years. I was quite successful. I gave away a sales manager's job to become a salesperson.
Yep.
For a product that nobody had ever heard of. The media were calling it the V8 Camry.
Yeah.
And I'll just add one little factor to it. We launched it in the middle of the recession that we had to have. Yeah. So it wasn't just a V8 Camry that it was referred to, but it was also $127,000 in 1990.
Wowzers.
Now, I took that role on and demoted myself, if you like, to become a prestige car salesperson.
Yeah.
I now own that business. So the thought behind that for me was that if you'd nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Yeah.
I've been doing what I was doing for a long time. I always had something to fall back on. If I wanted to become a sales manager in Toyota again, I could. But the opportunity to launch something new that nobody had heard of that was really going to challenge me was never going to come by again. So I took the punt and I backed myself, more importantly, and now I own it. So, yeah, for me that was a really – and in between that, I left Lexus 5 years after I joined it.
Yeah.
Went to Mercedes-Benz for 5 years and then was poached by Lexus and was offered the CEO role of Lexus Australia, which I did for 9 years.
Yeah, wow.
So you talk about sliding moments. Yeah, that's probably a really good question that I didn't have prepared the answer, but it's in my mindset.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that because what I'm picking up out of that is you've been willing to back yourself.
Yeah, sometimes you've got to take 2 steps back to go forward. There's nothing wrong with that. It could be a bomb that's gone off, but moving back in your practice, things aren't going well, realign, readjust, go back to basics, have a look at it. What am I doing wrong? Sometimes it's 2 or 3 things that forces the issue or creates the issue, but 90% you've got right.
Yeah.
So don't be hard on yourself. Make that decision, back yourself and go again.
Perfect. Hey, John, you've been really, really generous with your time today, mate, and I want to say thank you, not just from me, but from all of our listeners here at Savvy Dentist.
Thanks, Jeff.
I've really just enjoyed the conversation and I've been looking forward to it for so long, as I said, because I've been listening to you on various shows and now I've had the opportunity to talk to you myself. I'm tremendously grateful. So I just want to say I appreciate your time, mate.
Thank you, Jess, and I really appreciate the opportunity as well. Thank you for the chat.
All right, mate. Well, take good care. And ladies and gents, if you want to check out Sydney City Toyota and Lexus, you know where to go. Go and find John and I'm sure you'll be one of his guests down there. So thanks, mate.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.